But from my personal perspective, and talking to quite a few of the citizens that live along Miramar, and talking about the options, it seems like most of them would like to see some kind of improved riprap or revetment down to Shell Beach. They said, please save Shell Beach. Don't put a wall down there. Mm-hmm. It seems to be a natural nourishing beach for almost 200 feet that nobody has ever had to restore or feed it, even after Ike. They just plow the shells back and let it go. And it becomes quite usable. And what that really boils down to, in that report, there's one that has the revetment from the northwest end to the pier, mm-hmm. and then a beach from there on down. They said, no, take the revetment down to approximately the Shell Beach. Mm-hmm. And what kind of a revetment, whether it's a cement wall or a riprap, don't seem to be too particular. Some decent protection for the Miramar Park and, of course, for the citizens on the waterfront. But we're not looking for a Galveston-type seawall. And like I said, I've talked to quite a few of the residents that are not members of this committee. That's the way they feel about it. They really don't like the idea of a marsh, a salt marsh. They don't like the idea of the breakwaters or the groins out there because there's an awful lot of personal boating out in that area when you start putting those kind of structures out there. And I know you're not supposed to drink and drive, but people are going to get hurt. They're going to lose sight of the structures and run into them. But here's the option that they seem to talk about the most.
It's the draft 2A from that book is what it is.
And just extending that recommended seawall all further down to Shell Beach.
I think in our last meeting we also talked maybe expanding Shell Beach a little bit because it gets very crowded, you know, on weekends, the way it is.
Yeah.
But, not all the way back.
I stepped off Shell Beach after the meeting. The area that's got shells now is, by my measurement, about 180 feet. Mm-hmm. And if you went out to 300 feet, you would probably have an area that would almost all self-nourish. Of course, the part that nourishes now should continue because the be no changes to the yacht club waterfront.
Yeah,
that's what's causing that self-nourishment in that corner.
Yeah, I should have mentioned that. Basically what I think is happening is when the winds are out of the north, the waves are coming and they're pushing whatever shell. Maybe if there's a little bit of sand as well, pushing it this direction.
Mm-hmm.
When the predominant winds are out of the southeast, there's nothing, it's in the lee here, and so there's no push back to the north. So it's a trap. It's a one-way, things get in, but they can't get out.
And
which is good.
That's a self-nourishing beach. And that's kind of, I'm pretty much in agreement with that kind of a discussion, if that's...
And when we all met our first meeting a couple of weeks ago, that was the consensus of everyone at the table, all eight of us at the table, that that's what we'd like to look at. Some variation of that model, and we're going to rely on Larry to tell us how the engineering of that can be accomplished.
And when we get to that point, a couple of citizens gave me some questions to ask you about... the groins or whatever it is that are coming out here, I've understood that causes an unnaturally high tide to push when the water would come in. Is that true or not? Would be right there where the dock is. We already have, that's the high tide there with that pushes back into Boldy Bayou.
The groin or something of that nature really would not affect very much. I mean, it may be, a few millimeters.
Oh, okay. Well, that was just a
not
question.
Not significant enough. But I will note if those groins the purpose of those is to hold the sand. So if you're not adding sand, there's really no purpose to put a structure like that.
That's something that other people are saying as far as small recreational boating, jet skis, catamarans, all that. What was the purpose of the run? And that's what I figured it was to hold the sand in.
Okay.
So if we just slightly extend Shell Beach, we could probably put a very small groin just to hold what's left there. But the other thing was, anywhere that there'd be a groin, what's causing the natural growth of Shell Beach is going to do it in each one of those groins also.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's going to take away from what's happening in the corner at the yacht club. So that's right. Something else. And that's going to also, if you put one by the boat ramp, then you're going to fill the boat ramp up and the pier.
Right.
You're going to walk it out 100 feet over Shell
before
you can even get to the water. Those were some things that were brought up, and
exactly.
It's what we agreed of as a group, and what we've heard from other citizens, you know, looking at this going, what is all this, you know? But an enhanced revetment, something that will withstand and the rocks won't blow over Miramar, be it, you know, a rock or, like you had mentioned, matting. I've seen matting come out very well as a revetment, where you can actually get the natural grass grows up through it. We had kind of discussed that in our meeting too, where it gives you good water protection, but it'll also let some of the seagrass grow along the edge of it. Easily maintainable. That's just some of the things that were thrown out.
Do you have examples, visual examples of the various types of revetments?
I do, and we can go into that now. I was kind of going to wait until we're later, but let's just kind of go through. These may not be perfect pictures. Some of them were ones I had. Some of them were ones I went out and got. This is a revetment. This is actually a project down in Texas City. This is a lower point of the revetment. Where we actually had a weir created basically for water to flow in and out. So, but you can see this is limestone. This is a typical, I think this is a 1,500 pound gradation, which means the largest stones in the gradation are 1,500 pounds. That's pretty typical for what you're going to come up with in Galveston Bay area, where you've got design ways in the 6 foot type of range. So that's.
That is sloping a lot more than what we have now. So would we have more of a slope on Miramar? Would that be?
Yeah, so that's a good point. The flatter you build the slope, the smaller the rocks can be.
Okay.
The steeper into the slope is, the bigger the rocks have to be for the same size wave. So typically some type of slope around either what we call 2-to-1, so that's 2 steps horizontal for 1 step vertical.
About a 30-degree slope.
Yeah. Somewhere between there and 3-to-1 is usually the optimum. And what we do is we look at the economics of, a flatter slope, which requires a little bit more length along it, versus a steeper slope and larger rocks. So it's kind of an economic game we play. But what's out there now, I think, is more typically, 1-to-1.
It
it's
is.
It's very steep.
Yeah.
So,
now, would this,
go ahead.
Would this worship on Miramar in a Category 3 storm?
No. This, a well-designed, I mean, the key is, if you say design it for a 6-foot wave, it should withstand a 6-foot wave. If you have a 10-foot wave, yes, it's going to displace the rocks. I don't think nearly to the extent, I've never seen rocks displace nearly to the extent you've seen the riprap along Miramar.
Right.
But actually on this Texas City project, there was some smaller rock that went through Ike and got displaced, some of it maybe 20 or 30 feet. As part of the restoration, basically what we did was pick that rock back up and move it to where it was.
But some of that was displaced during Ike was pretty big pieces of concrete.
Yeah. Now, like I said, there's a density that, concrete's usually about 140, 145 pounds per cubic foot. The rock we spec 160, and that seems like a small difference, but it's actually the buoyant weight that makes a difference. So you take out of that the weight of the seawater or the buoyancy effect, and that delta becomes a lot bigger.
Another thing that I'm familiar with, like you were talking about the 30-degree slope on the riprap, that is your almost a natural level of energy dissipation for a seawall. the natural seawall is built at about 30 degrees.
Yeah.
And that pretty well handles whatever storms is in that area. And the energy dissipation is what is important here.
Yeah.
If you go the 2-to-1 rise, you're at 30, like you said, about 30 degrees. You go 1-to-1, you've got to be at about 45. And that is a lot harder to dissipate any storm energy coming in.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you get a kind of sloshing motion up the rocks.
Yeah, we just got hammered. Like I said, it was about a 45 degree slope down and random size rock.
Yeah.
And it worked very well for 50 years.
Would there be any fill?
Okay, yeah, that's a good question. And I saw the reclaim written along there. And that's one of the things I want to get a feel from you guys. In terms of fill, there's two issues. One, now you're filling areas that maybe you can document this used to be fast land, but from a Corps of Engineers perspective, that has not been fast land for some years. Now you're taking on activity of filling in waters of the U.S., which is not necessarily to say that you can't get a permit to do it, but it does become a little bit more difficult to get that permit. The second issue is just from a constructability standpoint. It's harder to place fill into the water and get it compacted to make a good base, you know, for your revetment or whatever you want to put on top of it. It's not impossible to do, but it's more difficult. So you run into more quality control type issues during construction. In general, my preference as a design engineer is to cut back slightly such that you have a good, well-compacted natural base to build on.
From the water's, you would then go from the present water's edge back.
Back, exactly.
Right.
And so if you're flattening the slope a little bit, that means the top of the slope may get pushed back, you know, say 5 or
sure.
10 feet.
Sure.
And the base of the slope stays about where it's at. But to the extent you can avoid filling and compacting in the water, it makes construction a lot easier and permitting. And most likely you're going to wind up with a better
product
life.
Yeah. Okay.
So, not to say we can't look at reclaiming some areas. I know on the north side,
it's very thin.
It's yeah, pretty narrow.
Yeah.
So, another issue I'll throw out as part of this is, so we're focusing on the shoreline itself, but are we trying to accomplish adding any protection to the properties or the infrastructure from Miramar, you know, on to the west? And that's a question, you know, an open question to you guys. Is that something that you're trying to accomplish out of this project or not?
Do you mean out in the water?
No. I mean, basically, if we raise the land up, we can break some of the wave energy that may be coming in on a ice-type storm and offer some degree of protection to the homes and the infrastructure along there.
I mean, to raise Miramar Park?
Yeah. Or even to the extent of a berm or something of that, you know, maybe not the entirety of the park. And I'm throwing that out. I'm not trying to suggest that's what you guys want, but it's a question.
And the reason that would give more protection from the waves.
But from people talking too, they don't want to change the aesthetics of the shoreline the way that it is right now.
Well, we have a lot of ground level houses there, also, which
you can drive down the street and look over and you see a grass berm, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like you're going
down, the water.
Like you're going down there around the Texas City guys.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there's a balance to play. You know, maybe it's something that you guys say, yeah, maybe we want to try and raise, you know, raise it up a foot or 2 feet, or maybe raise some areas. For example, where Boggy Bayou comes in, it's lower than the surrounding areas.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, because that is so low there.
Yeah. But, of course, that'll also mean we had to look at the hydraulics of the, you know, just normal rainfall runoff.
Because it's still going to be able to move that water out.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I think our first first objective with this whole project has been the shoreline restoration. I mean, we want to make sure we don't lose any more of the shoreline, because everything, and if you flatten out a riprap, we're going to lose a little shoreline at that. Which, on that one end so narrow, that's going to be maybe problematic.
Yeah, and we may not have the same, you know, we may not have the same solution or same criteria for the entire loop.
Okay, that's also sure.
Because I know down there about where we live, we lost during the hike. We lost, we used to be able to park two pickup trucks there for the 4th of July, and now you can't comfortably do that, really.
Yeah. There was about a 10 foot loss along there.
Certain places.
And it's almost on the north end. There's one area on the south end where it dug in pretty deeply, but on a restoration, it won't be reclaiming, it won't be filling water. There's one area that the hard grass coming back in, and that washed away real bad. But that's just, that is part of the restoration, is to refill that.
Yep.
Also, a berm, unless you add some additional stormwater exit improvements, the berm could hold water behind it.
Right.
Once it comes over.
Yeah, it's difficult, maybe not impossible, but difficult to have a continuous berm. You might have to do culverts or something like that, but you're right. Basically, anywhere you have an opening, what you actually can do, if you say you have a continuous berm and a 10-foot gap in it to let the water out, well, now you've maybe made things much worse than that 10-foot gap,
right,
or just behind that 10-foot gap.
Yeah.
Eric, can I ask, on the option, the preferred option, is the reason the revetment is on the north side a cost issue? Because beach nourishment couldn't extend the whole life.
As I recall, I think we had options that were, you know, beach nourishment,
the whole thing,
and then we looked at some kind of combinations.
Right.
I think in general the feedback was the north end, there was not much interest in doing any type of a
beach
or
and there's not a whole lot of interest in extending the beach from Shell Beach going north at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, you know, a small amount, like I said, extending, providing for the possible beach out to 300 feet is the maximum that I've discussed with anybody, or anybody has mentioned to me that it'd be nice to make it a little bit longer, accommodate a few more people.
And that's because people don't really have the need to use the beach. It's not a destination.
Well, that's not it. We're not wanting people from Sylvan Beach looking across the bay going, wow, Shore Acres have a really nice beach, and this is kind of crowded. Let's just go down the bay and we'll go party over there and throw our cans everywhere.
They do it anyhow.
Right.
So you don't want to create an attractive...
Exactly.
It's not really... Is the real value then, it's really just the view, right?
No, this is used. I mean, people swim there.
This is for everything. They fish, and the yacht club uses this a lot to launch their little sailboats.
Okay. When they're their summer schools, they use that a lot.
If you want to wade across that front, you go in and you get easy water access there, and then you can walk across that overbet, you know, to the pier and back, and you know, you got easy water access.
I see a lot of people wade fishing out there.
I've seen
somebody riding a horse out there in the water before.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the residents launch small
kayaks and small sailboats.
And the jet skis and all that.
And jet skis.
Yeah. They'll launch it at the pier and go down there and
picnic.
We just don't want to use the non-residents.
It's the park. I think we felt like we needed anything more. We have it serves its purpose. Mm-hmm. It's good, and we don't have to re-nourish it all the time. You know, it's good like it
is. Who owns Miramar Park? Is it
City Shore Acres?
It's city right away.
Is it the city right away?
Yeah.
With the exception of the parking lot adjacent to the fishing field.
Now that's leased from the city.
Yeah, it's
still city property. We lease it from the association. Leases it from the city. So it's still city property.
So it's not dedicated parkland, it's just access right away?
No, it is dedicated parkland.
Okay. Yeah.
It's
not county.
Public use, okay.
Yeah.
Which some of each is county.
From a legal perspective, any citizen can use it no matter where they live.
Right.
And everyone that's a resident can use the boat launch and the pier?
No.
Yeah, they can, but it's a membership only.
Yes,
separate. Okay.
Yeah, uh-huh. It's a not-for-profit supporting organization. I think that's a 501c6.
And you can join even if you're not a resident.
No,
you have to be a resident.
You have to be a resident. Yeah.
Do you have any idea what percentage of residents are actually members?
About 30%.
Now, Chuck, did you expand the membership to include some of the port residents down there, didn't you?
Bayshore. The Bay Colony.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, a 501c6, you have to specify what your membership area is. And last year, we extended to the Bay Colony people. Mm-hmm. We've had not very many of them join because they finally got their own pier back in condition.
Yeah.
But for years, they didn't have, their pier was destroyed by Ike, too. We just got ours going first, so we expanded the area. But it is a specified and documented area that where people can join from.
So in terms of the shoreline project, we are not planning to do anything that's going to, affect the pier or the boat ramp. We'll obviously have to join into those.
Yeah.
And if we're doing a revetment, we'll go along that portion of the shoreline as well.
Yeah.
But we're not planning to try and wrap any improvements or anything on the pier or the boat ramp into this.
No, basically the boat ramp.
We did talk about the boat ramp.
Pardon?
I said we did, last meeting we talked about if it would be possible to...
Let's
flesh that out for Larry and James. On the boat ramp. Chuck, you had the best description of it.
Well, actually what it is when you go down the ramp, the concrete ends, mm-hmm. and the wheels of the trucks have created a ditch.
Yeah.
And so the back of the truck has water in the bed, and the boat, and then it goes back up, so the boat's on a trailer and you can't get it off.
Yeah. That's at low tide. That's a real problem watching.
That's at low
tide. Get some pretty low tides here. Under normal conditions, it works pretty well. But of course, when and the buildup of the sand behind the launching ramp is from people loading their boats. Mm-hmm. There's only one way to do it: you rev it up and slide it up on your trailer, and that builds up behind. And that's where we get into trouble with the low tide because that does build up, and it sucks the sand away from the end of the cement on the ramp. That's why that hole is there.
Yeah.
You know, we built it ourselves, but we went as far out on the ramp as we could. We didn't realize that it's going to be that much of a problem.
It'd be nice if it go out further.
Okay.
From the concrete.
That's a question that we'll kind of need to flush out.
Can you even do it?
Well, yeah, I think that's the question if we're pursuing grant funding, I think it'll be difficult. It's much easier to say this is all public infrastructure that we're improving. I think when we're talking about potentially improving something that's a private membership, even if it's a 501c6 or whatever, that may be a little bit tougher.
I don't think that we can use government funds of any kind to improve that ramp. We're going to have to come up with
Might it be like the road project, though, that once they're out there, we might get a better deal from the company who's there to do
We've done that before,
we might
too.
Think about how we're going to fund
that before
it starts.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Because as long as they're there.
Yeah. When they were doing all the road work around here, we let them park in our private lot, And they come by and they gave us 2 inches of rock to put on. They really improved that parking lot.
I will say
that. And that we can maybe work something.
Yeah. On most projects, I try and shy away from those kind of deals when you have private.
You shouldn't shy away from them, but I don't have to.
Especially on something where it's an association that's doing it as opposed to each individual homeowner.
Yeah.
Right. And it becomes tough as an engineer to account for, well, where did that rock go? Did it go on Moss House?
The project engineer was the one that proved the dumping and grading. So, but that was between literally me and him.
Yeah.
But that was just to make sure those trucks didn't get stuck in there. So they needed that extra.
It helped them too. But we started out, there was no other place within a mile to park their trucks.
Yeah.
And there would be 12, 14 large trucks in our parking lot. We had a few people complain and said, park along the Miramar and walk. It ain't that far.
Yeah.
But it worked out real well. But it was never documented. It was the same when they put the culverts in on Boggy Bayou. Mm-hmm. They put in, 200, 250 feet of culverts.
And
they gave us 2 loads of rock for the parking lot. Yeah. So maybe we can work something out, but don't know.
Yeah.
You don't want to, I don't think you even want to approach that.
Yeah.
We got these guys that like for you to build them a real nice ramp.
Yeah.
No, you can't use it, but
okay. So I just want to make sure we're all on the same page. We kind of got a little off topic. You want to look through some of the other pictures here. So this is a concrete mat revetment. They go through different names. Sometimes you hear articulating block mats or cellular concrete mattress. This again was down in Texas City. What these are, they're about a 8 foot wide by 40 foot long section of concrete. They're almost like paver blocks. And they're strung together with typically with nylon rope, and that rope is not so much to hold them together; it's just for placing. And then you use a crane to pick them off a flatbed. The crane has a big spreader bar, swings them out, and lays them down on top of. And in this case, these were just laid directly on top of the geotextile fabric. And you can see the excavator working out ahead of it and get a nice graded area out ahead of it.
And are they anchored in any way?
Yeah, typically at the top end at least, sometimes both at the top and the toe, you use either helical anchors, or which is like what they use on a mobile home, or what they call duckbill anchors, so it's an anchor that you drive in and then pull against, and it kind of has a plate that rotates out and you can get tension against. Anchoring them at the toe is fairly difficult, especially if you get in more than about 2 or 3 feet of water depth. And you do have to have people lacing these things together or tying them together. Even though those cables aren't really there for structural purposes, we go ahead and tie them all together as much as we can. So it's somewhat labor intensive. It does require a crew pulling, doing all this, people in the water. But it goes really fast. I mean, they can swing and place one of these mats in 30 minutes or so. So it's just boom, boom, boom. Mm-hmm. Now, what I will say, the actual design requirements, this was not really up to the design standards, which actually call for putting down fabric, and then crushed rock, more fabric, more crushed rock, and then the block mat. By the time you do all that, the cost becomes comparable to what you'd have with rock to begin with. Mm-hmm. In general, also, the rule of thumb is that these are good up to about a 6 foot wave height. So it's really kind of on the edge of what we would probably see in a major storm here. I think the other issue, this was actually that same site, what we were replacing, that had been there for a number of years, maybe 10 or 15 years. You can see what happens is if your ground underneath is not well compacted, you wind up with a lot of settlement issues. Now, this is along the Texas City Channel, and I think a lot of what was happening here is the barges come push up against that. Mm-hmm. So some of that may have been caused by barges, but I've seen a lot of cases where you get, over time, you get some, you know, undulations in these, and, you know, they don't necessarily aesthetically look as good as they did on day one.
And is that the same kind of map that you showed in the previous picture?
It is the same. It may be a different manufacturer, but it's the same general type. It's I think that was a 5-inch thick mattress, which is not the thickest. They go up to 8-inch or 9-inch thick.
So when that mat was originally laid down, it would have been a similar surface as the previous slide, so it should have been just one flat plane.
Yeah. Now I didn't observe it before that, so I can't say for sure that the quality.
But you would assume that's the way the engineer would have done it.
But the other thing is, we'd have to take out everything that's there to do to put that in.
Yeah, I think any way we go about this, that concrete riprap needs to come out.
Okay.
I don't think you want that as a base layer. I think just adding on top of it's kind of it's like painting over bad paint. You just scrape it off.
Eric, what's the function of the voids there?
Primarily just open space, make it a little cheaper, save on material. There's not a hydraulic purpose to
it. Doesn't help it.
You do see sometimes vegetation growing through them. You've got to put a geotextile fabric under them. That's so usually if the vegetation is growing up, it means that you've got a hole in the fabric, which is not good. Now the flood control district uses these on some catchment basins, etc., where they intentionally are getting vegetation growing in them, but you don't have quite the same velocities that you do when you have wave attacks. So from a coastal perspective, I don't think you want vegetation coming up. Then kind of the next step up, if you will, and I tried to come up with pictures from kind of similar environments. This is actually down in Palacios, on Matagorda Bay on Palacios, Trace Palacios Bay. So it's probably maybe a little bit more protected than the shorefront here in Shore Acres, but you can see they've got a concrete seawall. This is probably about a 2 or 3 feet up, and then there's just a beach in front of it. I'm not sure if this has been nourished over time or if it's, you know, strictly a natural beach. This would be kind of a concrete seawall approach. In my experience, I've not had a project where it really costed something like this out. My expectation is this would be a fairly expensive option, but you do wind up with, you know, from a architectural perspective, it's a very nice looking structure. You can put a handrail, etc.
What kind of waves?
You could design a concrete seawall like this. I think you could design up to, you know, the waves that we
stay higher.
Yeah, higher, heavier, basically more massive. It's just resisting on mass.
What about life cycle cost as far as going under the seawall? Is there a lot of maintenance on?
We do have to protect the toe of that seawall, and so typically what you'd have is some kind of riprap at the base of the toe. Like the Galveston seawall during Ike, it actually was exposed all the way down, and they did get some erosion underneath. They had to replace some of that. Actually, Galveston seawall, interesting, is on timber piles. So the beach is there to protect the piles so the marine boars don't attack the piles and the whole seawall settles. So when that got exposed, it was very critical to them to get that, you know, covered up very quickly.
But that's because it was log,
yeah,
and we wouldn't be using that.
No, I don't think we would use timber piles. Probably not very likely to use it. Then the other classic type of seawall is just a steel sheet pile, typically steel sheet piles. There's other types of sheet pile, vinyl, fiberglass, which I don't think really have the durability. Aluminum is good in areas where it's oxygenated soil. In an area like this where you've got clay, you actually would corrode the aluminum. So steel is basically the option here, and you know, you can get a good 25 to 30 plus year design life with steel. You can coat it, etc. But some point in the future, you are going to wind up with corrosion. Beach nourishment. This is down in this is Indianola Beach, again on Matagorda Bay. This is a project that was done about 10 or 15 years ago by the General Land Office. So they imported sand. This stretch was originally a sandy beach, but it was getting eroded back up towards the road, so they brought in additional sand and built these various groin-type structures, and this one is a T-head. So you can see these trap the sand. There's really nothing more magical to beach nourishment than you bring in sand. I mean, there's some design that goes into it, but it's, you know, that's basically all there is to it. This is down on Corpus Christi Bay. This is Texas A&M Corpus Christi. Around the same time period, about 15 years ago, they built a beach out in front of here. In part, this was supposed to be a research project. They built these breakwaters to protect it. You can kind of see, by the waves are wrapping around. What's actually happened is it's very shallow all the way out to these breakwaters. And low tide, you know, this basically becomes almost all dry land here. And then in terms of wetlands, this is a project along the Intercoastal Waterway that I got from Parks and Wildlife. They're building a breakwater revetment out in front to protect these wetlands. Now, what you could also do is build something and then pump material back in behind it, dredge material most likely, and fill this in, and then, you know, create marsh where there's not marsh now. So that's, I just wanted to get kind of some examples out there so everybody has sort of the same pictures in their head when we talk about a seawall or a bulkhead. We're all using the same vocabulary.